Hi, everybody. Welcome to Booktales with Rand Dugas and Heather Fowler. Today, we are excited to feature Lynn Melnick, author of Refusenik, a book of poems to be published by Yes Yes Books in 2022.
Booktales, Readings, Cocktails, and Craft is a monthly podcast series with live author readings, custom cocktails, and discussions on the craft of writing. Why cocktails? Well, we thought that having a cocktail while listening to your favorite author chat and give a reading would be a pretty cozy idea. Today, we are drinking a black and white Russian inspired by Lynn's poetry collection. The recipe is on the Hot Redhead Media blog link in the podcast description if you'd like to make one and have it with us.
For those not familiar with Lynn, Lynn Melnick is the author of the poetry collections Refusenik, Landscape with Sex and Violence, and If I Should Say I Have Hope. She is also the co-editor of Please Excuse This Poem, 100 Poets for the Next Generation. Her poetry has appeared in APR, The New Republic, The New Yorker, The Paris Review, Poetry, and A Public Space. Her essays have appeared in Air/Light, LA Review of Books, ESPN, and the anthology Not That Bad, Dispatches from Rape Culture. She has received grants from the Café Royal Cultural Society and the Hadassah Brandeis Institute. A former fellow at the New York Public Library's Coleman Center for Scholars and Writers and previously on the executive board of VITA, Women in Literary Arts, she currently teaches poetry at Columbia University and the 92Y. Born in Indianapolis, she grew up in Los Angeles and currently lives in Brooklyn. Her memoir, I've Had to Think Up a Way to Survive, On Trauma, Persistence, and Dolly Parton, is forthcoming from the University of Texas Press's American Music Series in 2022.
In Refusenik, this searing new volume, Lynn Melnick dives headfirst through concentric waves of personal and generational trauma with her trademark fearlessness. Evincing a complex mind shaped by the late 20th century misplaced priorities, Refusenik interrogates misogyny and anti-Semitism across time and a shifting global landscape. From a football field in Los Angeles to a Russian shtetl to a beloved daughter's Brooklyn bedroom, variously unraveling and allowing for intricate tangles of anger, nostalgia, and love, these agile poems furrow deeper into the terrain of Melnick's much-celebrated earlier titles, arriving at a profound and pressured understanding of what it means to be a contemporary American. We'd like to let our listeners know that this episode may at times discuss the topic of sexual violence and mention the word rape.
I am so glad you're here today. How are you doing today, Lynn?
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here. I am well. Thank you.
Wonderful. Well, today we're really looking forward to talking with you about your work and having you give us a reading a little bit later. Do you enjoy giving live readings?
Well, it's funny. I haven't given an in-person reading since March of 2020. I do enjoy it. I am an anxious person and public speaking doesn't come naturally to me, but I have gotten used to it since I do much more of it than I ever would have imagined for my life. I do like reading via Zoom or, you know, giving readings online because I'm in my own space and not standing up in front of a crowd. So maybe that's easier.
Yeah, I think all writers are anxious a little bit.
Right? We're writers. We're not
writers,
not necessarily, anyway.
I have a question about your collection. I wanted to know if you'd tell us about your poems, if there was one poem that shaped, that kind of started your idea for this collection and how you put them together and how they connect. If you could just tell us a little bit about that.
Absolutely. So I came up with the idea for this collection after I finished my last book, which was Landscape with Sex and Violence, and I was actually writing a grant proposal, and I was like, what do I want to write next? And I just sort of thought, one thing that I haven't written a lot about, but which deeply informs me, is my Jewishness. I'm not a particularly religious person, but I'm very culturally Jewish, and I have been very formed and informed by Jewish traditions and ideas. And so I thought, I'm going to write about Jewishness and anti-Semitism and all of these things that sort of have made me, or a part of what has made me. And I really thought I had this idea for what this book would be. And I got this grant and I had this fellowship and I had a year at the New York Public Library just to work on this book. Yeah, it was amazing.
That sounds wonderful.
It is honestly like the dream. I can't, like, you get paid to sit on your ass and write for an entire year in the New York Public Library in that big flagship building with the lions. And it's incredible. And I thought, okay, I'll go into their archives and I'll read about, you know, maybe where my ancestors came from. I didn't know exactly what the book would be, but I thought it would be about what it was like living in challenging times for Jewish people, which now seems very naive to me because I wrote the grant before Trump was elected. I got the grant after he had been elected, and I started at the library right after, like, all of those protests by the neo-Nazis and Heather Heyer had and people were marching in the street saying Jews will not replace us. And suddenly, and I show up at the library going to write this, like, historical book. I can't do that. That's not, like, this stuff is happening still and right now. So it changed my feeling for the book. And the other thing I think that formed this book, the title poem, Refusenik, was the last poem I wrote for the book, almost the last poem I wrote for the book, and was the one that I was expecting to write in a different way, but it turned into, obviously, what you write always somehow becomes bigger than what you had imagined.
Almost always.
This one thing, and then it, like, literally has everything in my life in it. But I wanted to write about my relationship with this young man that when I was a child, my family would take in what we called refuseniks, which were Soviet Jews who had been refused visas to leave the country. And when they were able to escape the Soviet Union, this was the 1980s, families would come stay with us for a while until they were established in Los Angeles, where we live. And I had, you know, a friendship with one young man in particular. And I wanted to write about that, like what it was like to be in the 1980s in Los Angeles, which was a real kind of like rah-rah, go USA moment. You know, the Olympics had just happened. There was a lot of USA versus USSR kind of thing happening. And it was just a very weird moment to be a Jew and an American and all of this in this poem that I wanted to write to sort of form the book. But it was a really hard poem to write. It's very, very long. And it took me almost the entire fellowship year to get it right. I almost scrapped it at one point.
Because
It wasn't working. And the weird thing about poems is that the way they look and the stanza lines and lengths and the line lengths and all of that really changes how the poem is read. So when I wrote the poem and it was in, like, I had these long stanzas and it was in sections and I was just completely almost ready to scrap it. And then I changed the line lengths and I made it all one stanza with, like, little asterisks when I needed a pause, and it completely worked, and I didn't change one word of the
poem. Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it was like, it went from, like, honestly feeling like I had completely failed. I was utter failure at this book to being, like, super jazzed. Like, oh my God, I fixed this poem and it works and I can have a book now. So that was, I think, what I wasn't ready to write this poem until almost the end. And so a lot of the poems that I wrote for the book were kind of like warm up to just get to what I really wanted to say. And I just needed, like, I feel like my first book was the book I needed to write in order to be able to write my second book. And I feel like they've all kind of been that way.
So interesting.
Yeah. You have to just work through stuff so you can get to the next thing.
Right.
Yeah. That's the longer poem with the character V in it, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, I love that piece.
Thank you.
Interesting. I'm so glad you talked about the construction of it. So this is a two-part question kind of connected to this. Did you always imagine you'd be a poet or write poetry? And for you, you discussed this about this collection, but do the same impulses inform your decisions towards other new collections? Because you've had three, right?
This is my third.
So do you feel like that's changing with every time you write a book, or how does that work for you?
Let me just understand, like, do I feel like what is changing?
Do you feel like the reason you're right or how you're, okay, I'll give you an example. For example, I feel like my first book of short stories was a compilation from about 10 different years of short story writing. And it was just like, these all seem like they'll fit. But then another collection that I wrote, I felt like I was writing all of one thread.
Right.
And then another one, I felt like, oh, this is thematically connected. So I'm pulling in stories from different decades and that sort of thing, because it was about whatever the main theme is or something. But I feel like every book is its own little weird baby, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I just finished editing another book and I seriously feel postpartum depression at the moment.
Yeah, you know, every book has its own little quirks, its own little nose.
It's true.
Let's do this. So I was just wondering, for you, how does this work for you?
Yeah.
Is it that kind of a crazy process like mine is, or is it a little more organized?
I do tend to be a very organized person, but I don't know about about creatively. So to answer the first part of the question, did I always know I was going to be a poet? When I actually started writing punk song lyrics when I was a teenager, many of which I still remember, but I'd have to drink a lot of those black and white Russians to quote them.
We're coming for those.
So that I thought, okay, that would be the coolest thing, right? To write song lyrics. And then I discovered an anthology of U.S. poets and also a book by the poet Diane McCoskey, both in a Goodwill store in Los Angeles. And they just blew my brain open. And I thought, well, this is what poetry can do, because poetry that I had read earlier in school was not that. It was mostly men, and it wasn't just sort of really like, I think with Diane McCoskey, her poetry was so angry, and I needed that at that point in my life. And I thought, oh, well, yeah, you know, I'm writing these punk song lyrics, right? Obviously I was angry. So I think, like, if you can write anger into poems, then wow, like, what can't poetry do? And then I had the good fortune, when I was later in community college, I won second place in the Women's History Month poetry contest. And I was given this, I think it was $75 gift certificate to the Sisterhood Bookstore, which was sadly now closed feminist bookstore in Los Angeles. And I spent it all poetry, and I got to learn what was out there, because they had a very sort of a selection that was definitely curated to my tastes. So that's sort of how I got started as a poet. At one point, I thought I might be a playwright, and I just finished writing this memoir in prose, and that's not something I ever thought I would do. And definitely, I felt like I was at the beginning of something again, like when I wrote my first book of poems. Yeah, it's very exciting, I think, to sort of be completely out on a wire, not knowing what you're doing, which I think I needed. And I hope that when I go back now to poetry, I can take some of that energy with me. But to answer the second part of your question, which I think sort of fits, you were saying about your short story collection, the first one being sort of you had taken a long time to write it, so there were a lot of disparate stories. That's sort of how my first poetry book was. Mm-hmm. I have poems in there from when I was 20, and I have poems in there from when I was in my later 30s. It took me a long time to write the first book for various reasons. I couldn't get my shit together. And I published my first book of poems when I was 39. And it just has like many, many years and different me's, basically. And so that's, to me, I can feel it. I tried, of course, to arrange them, you know, so that it would read kind of seamlessly. But I know, you know, it's like, you know, that it's like when you edit something and you know what was there, you always feel the ghost of that.
Right.
I feel like that with my first book. I also, one of the reasons I was so hesitant to publish the first book was because it had a lot of poems about domestic violence and about sexual assault and things that I just thought, like, oh, the sky is going to fall in when I give people my life in this way. And then I published it. Nothing happened. It sort of freed me up to write my second book, which was Landscape with Sex and Violence, which is, I think, will always be the book that I feel like I was sort of born to write, because it is so much about rape culture and about violences that have happened to me and happened to many women and many people. But then having written that book, it sort of freed me up to, it had me letting go of a lot of the things that had consumed me. I had sort of laid bare my history, and I was able to sort of go deeper, I think. I mean, this book, Refusenik, is also has a lot of, it has violence and sexual violence in it, but I think it goes a little more broad than Landscape with Sex and Violence did. And so I felt like I just keep moving forward with each book. When I finished Refusenik, I felt like I needed to write something that brought me joy. I write stuff. And that's when I started writing this memoir. That's also a book about Dolly Parton, because, like, nothing is more joyous than Dolly Parton.
I love that so much.
She's just, you know, she's just all joy for me. So even if my memoir stuff is hard, like, she's just all joy. And I, and now I'm in this place where I finished that book, I finished Refusenik, and, like, what is next? I don't know. I guess we'll find out.
Yeah. I have a question about that. I'm curious about how writing poetry versus writing prose felt for you, or how it was different or the same.
That's a very good question. I mean, one of the things about writing poetry, it's not nonfiction, right? Like, you can change details about something. And so I have a poem, you know, in my last book, which talks about trading a dress I loved for a bottle of rum. But I actually, when I was a kid, but I actually traded it for a bottle of whiskey, right? So you can do that in a poem. You know, you can trade it for like a swan or like Saturn if you want. You can do whatever you want in a poem. So, but you can't do that in nonfiction. And it's very different. A lot of the stories that are in my last book and in Refusenik are going to be in my memoir. And I had to, one story that factors in, and I'm going to read this poem later, is a poem called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. It's a story of a difficult situation I found myself in with a rabbi whose kid I was babysitting for. And I talk a lot about this, and the poem is less than a page. And it just sort of, it leaves a lot of room for imagination, and you don't have to go into everything. And in memoir, it's a bit different. And I think they really both get at the truth, but in just in different ways. And it's just, I wouldn't say one feels more vulnerable than the other, but it is a strange thing writing prose versus poetry, because prose, a lot of times you also have to, like, you're telling the story in a somewhat narrative order. And in poetry, you can just leap around or leave stuff out or highlight things that aren't necessarily, they're just more like they sound beautiful, right? But they may not relate exactly to the story and things like that. So it's very, very different. And
interesting.
It was very curious because I do tell a lot of the stories that I've told in my poems in the memoir. And it's just it's a very different relationship, I think, to how they went down.
Yeah. You know, what's fascinating to me is I feel like, and okay, some people might want to stab me for saying this, but I feel like poets who write memoir are about 8,000% more honest than prose writers who write memoir. I mean, I feel like I've known people who've written fiction and memoir, and their memoir is like the iceberg on the surface of the water of what really happened. And, you know, so it's kind of like that weird disorienting, disenchanting thing when you're like, if you don't know someone, this seems like they're God's truth. But if you do know someone, this seems like an obfuscation of some kind. But I feel like poets are just a little bit more honest. I mean, I'd wonder if you would agree with that.
Well, I've certainly known some dishonest poets, I'll put it that way. But I think that we're just so used to sort of laying ourselves bare, that we sort of get used to doing it in a way where we can play around with how it sounds and how it feels and all this stuff, but we're really putting our whole heart there on the page, and it's like beating, and we're just, that's how we write. And then we move on to prose, and it's like, how do you stop doing
that? How do you stop that conditioned emotional nudity? How do you
exactly turn that off? And so it just occurs to me that the first drafts of both my poems and of my memoir are just so raw and so vulnerable. When I then go to edit the poem, I can be a little, I can hide stuff because I'm making it pretty and I'm doing fun things with line breaks, you know, and that's one kind of truth. And then when I'm writing prose, when I edit it, I think I can't pull back from that. I can't make it. So I think maybe that's part of it too. Like, we're so used to just sort of being raw, but then we can't pretty it up in the same way that you can with poetry.
Yeah. Well, speaking of that idea of being just very vulnerable and accessible on the page, I really love the poem in this collection, July 4th, 2017.
Mm. Thank you.
It really feels like it's about, for me anyway, among other things, this unabashed female sexuality embraced sort of concept, also self-love, also self-acceptance, also juxtaposition with male fragility, male violence, and male ego.
Yes.
How did this poem come to you? When? I love it. That's all I have to say about it. I want to hear you talk.
Well, thank you so much. The origin of this poem, one of the things about the book is I talk a lot about, I would say I talk a lot in this book and various poems about middle-aged female sexuality, right? Because I think that we have this idea that, like, women just sort of shrivel up after they have kids and then they have no need for sex. And I vehemently disagree with that. And I write a lot about what it's like to be still a sexual and a sexualized person in one's 40s. So that's always on my mind. And so it was a few things. One is that there really was this street vendor on just right near my subway station. So he was selling this shirt that said, I have no tits on. It was a tank top. Like, what, you know, and I happened to have tits, and I was just confused about who wears this shirt and what it's for. And he was selling it along with, like, flags and, like, Star Spangled hats and, like, weird July 4th merchandise. And so on the way to the street vendor too, there was a shopkeeper who was always kind of grunting at me as I walked. So, like, I'm always thinking, I live in New York City where street harassment is just a thing. And so I was thinking about that, like all of this stuff. I'm being sexualized. This shirt says I have no tits. It's almost July 4th. And then for a day and a half, somebody was playing Yankee Doodle on, like, some kind of, like, dinky sound system over and over and over again. And it was driving me bananas. And so to solve this, or to sort of combat this relentless Yankee Doodle happening, I looked it up on Wikipedia, which is what I do. I was like, I'm going to figure out Yankee. I'm going to solve Yankee Doodle. It's wacky. Like, I encourage everybody to look up the Wikipedia page for Yankee Doodle. It's got some really interesting lyrics, and which I use. The last line in the poem is a lyric from this poem, from that song. And so basically that was all of that stuff together, right? It was the idea of Americanness. It was the idea of what the United States was founded on patriarchy and guns. And then also like this rah-rah, go America kind of sense that gets in the air on July 4th and like all of that.
Just yeah, but coupled with the idea, I have no tits, as if patriotism is owned by men or something like that.
Yeah. Absolutely. And it, like, and we're just sort of merely decoration, I think, for anything that, you know, the men dream up, which is a feeling that I get a lot living in this country as a woman. So I'm so glad that you picked up on all of that, because there is, I think in my poems, there tends to be everything at once. And that's, I always wonder if it lands. So I'm happy to hear that it did.
Yeah, it definitely did. It did for me with that poem too. As you were talking, I was thinking there's so many images and so much imagery and sounds and all this stuff that came to you for this poem. When you're out in the world, I was curious, do you take a notebook with you? How do you like save the things you witness and experience to use in a poem?
Sometimes a line will come to me and I will write it down. I do have a pen with me at all times. Sometimes I'll even write on my phone in the notes section. Most of the time, I've sort of trained myself to just like, I know that poets are supposed to sit around waiting for the muse, and that sounds great and and ideal, but it's not, it doesn't work in my life. And so, you know, it's a little bit better now. My kids are older, but when they were small, when they were babies in particular, I didn't have the time to sit around waiting for the muse because I had like 15 minutes a day to myself. Mm-hmm. So it was like, as soon as I had that like little bit of time, it would be like hit the ground running and I would just write. And I didn't know what was going to come out. And so it was almost like everything that had been stored in my brain from the last 24 hours would just like sort of vomit out onto the page. And like, and that's how it would happen. And so I think a lot of the poems, because there is so much stuff in them, is me just holding everything in and then just like letting it go. I think that's maybe part of it. And because I was in that habit for so long, I tend to be sort of really romantic about writing and just kind of a nerd about it. I have a certain amount I want to do per day and I put it in my to-do list and I do it. I feel like such a nerd.
Yeah, I love a to-do list.
Right? It's really I love
that's awesome. Well, yeah. I have to say, Lynn, I think I met you in North Carolina at the gathering.
Oh, yes.
And I remembered you really well because I thought, I love how she's gearing people toward the idea of creating. I love how practical it is. I love how it is like, okay, now write something, you know.
And I sit down for 15 minutes and get some words on the page.
Yeah.
Go for it. Make it happen. Don't fool around here.
I loved the gathering. That was just just such a lovely weekend.
It is so wonderful. Like every single person there, I can't put a big enough positive, whatever that is, endorsement for that, because every single person there really cares about writing and good writing and other writing. Yeah.
And one of the things that I think, you know, I try to get across, especially when I do community workshops like what was at the gathering, is this idea of being more practical about writing. And I'm a little bit practical to a fault. If I get my family in here, they will tell you that. But I just think especially women have a hard time making time for themselves and making time for their art. And if you don't insist on it, then it's not going to happen sometimes, especially when you have family at home or you have other obligations and caretaking to do. There's always something else you could be doing, right? Like, except for my dream year at the New York Public Library, where that's what I was being paid to do. Most of my life is not that. And I think
you have to.
Right. And what's special about the gathering is it's like all these people have come to give themselves time to write. And I just want to always stress that it's possible to do that. It's possible to will writing into existence instead of, like, I think a lot of people think about poetry, just sort of waiting for the muse. I think a lot of what we think when we think of you always growing up, certainly I would always hear about these men who, you know, would go to their writing shed for 4 hours every morning.
And, oh, yeah.
And blah, blah, blah. Meanwhile, they had a wife who was bringing them food in the writing shed and with making the writing shed possible. And most of us don't have that. So what can we do? To me, I try to think of a practical way out of that problem.
That's so true. It's so true. And I love how in this collection, there's such a deep exploration of this triplicate thing of American female Jewish identity. And I think the female identity part resonates a lot with the amount of freedoms you can have as a writer or not have. But this echoes through a lot of the poems. Can you speak to what you'd like your reader to come away with regard to identity in terms of your poetics? And what themes are most important to you and when you're parsing them, religion or culture as a poet?
Yeah, I mean, I can try. as you know, I do have so much in each poem. But I think one of the things that has always and will always be something that is important to me is what becomes of a body that has been misused and that has been harmed. And that is an obsession of mine because that is my body. And I think that is the body of so many people who have been harmed by violence in some way. And you can't really shake that. That's something that you just have to live with. And so that is an identity. It's not an identity yeah. I wanted, but it's an identity I have. And I think that I never would have thought this when I was a young person, but I have sort of made a writing career out of speaking things that I never wanted to speak about, and which is a strange place to find myself. So that will always be something that is important to me in poetry, is to write what people can't look away from. So they know that, you know, the reality of what violence does to body. As far as the, you know, I think like many of us, I have a complicated relationship to being, you know, a United States citizen. Mm-hmm. And most of this book was written, I think all of this book was written during the Trump years. So that was hanging over my head.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
And during those years too, it became anti-Semitism was really on the rise. And I grew up in Los Angeles and I live in New York City. And those are places with a lot of Jews. And I never felt like an other until those years in watching TV, watching people sort of chanting against us and all of these anti-Semitic crimes. And, you know, it made me feel like even though I'm not a religious person, I felt it hurt. To see people wanting you to be destroyed merely because of the fact of your birth. I knew this as a woman, right? I knew misogyny deeply. I knew anti-Semitism on the level of my grandmother would start sentences when the Nazis come back for us. And I would think, well, oh, isn't that, you know, poor grandma, you know, she was so traumatized by mid-century. But I never felt it personally. And then I started to pretty late in life. And I think many Jews would be like, really? That's when you started to feel it? But that for me was my journey with it. And so I started thinking about that. And then at the same time, I was trying to figure out what my relationship to my Jewishness is. And so much of the Old Testament, which is what the Jews' belief system is based on, is so misogynistic and so just offensive. And the religion itself is so patriarchal. And I have a problem with that. And I feel like a lot of times it's sort of overlooked in these very neat ways, not neat like cool, but as in tidy of, yes, it was misogynistic, but now we're, you know, progressive Jews. But you're still following these texts that I find to be difficult, woman. And so I was trying to grapple with that because I am so, I say in the book, I'm nothing if not Jewish. I just feel that so strongly. Like I feel it, a woman so strongly, but I'm at odds with a lot of it. And so this book is really just me trying to come to terms with my Americanness and my Jewishness and then my middle-aged womanhood.
That's wonderful. Thank you for sharing that.
Sure.
In the poem, Tinseltown, yeah. I'm really interested in how you offer almost an alternate explanation as a way to offset what happens in the poem when you write, or else what if maybe we invented it at the end? And also the use of the double negative, didn't not give them blowjobs. I was wondering if you could talk about the poem, what you wanted to evoke, and your decision to sort of use these, I'm calling them softer rhetorical choices. I don't know that that's the right word, but when you do that kind of language in it, your decision to do that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's like one of the things I was talking about where when you write a poem, you can do that, right? If I was writing Tinseltown in prose, I would actually be telling you things I don't want you to know, you know, but like in a poem, you can sort of hint at stuff. And that's part of it. Like double negative is just something that I get a real kick out of.
Yeah.
It's just too much. It's right. It's just so much fun. And so that's part of it. Part of the thing, something that I do when I write, especially dark stuff, is write lines that just amuse me because I need to feel some delight when I'm writing hard stuff. And so,
yeah, that makes sense.
A lot of it is that. And so I think this one's a little bit snarky, saying like, oh, these were simpler times, that I'm talking about like stripping and, you know, all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, but, you know, we always think of earlier years as simpler times. And so I think I'm just looking at where we are now. Like the poem stems from being in LA, I think it was 2015, and seeing this faded girls dance sign and thinking about my own life when I lived in LA. I left in 1992. Yeah, 1992. And so just sort of thinking about like what had changed and just this idea of what the world is now versus what it was then. And so that's why that last line where I say the lines are, the bartenders did not give us matches. We did not give them blowjobs. This was before the sharing economy, or else what if maybe we invented it? It's just me sort of being a little snarky, just because I think it's funny that the sharing economy would be trading matches for blowjobs, right?
Yeah.
It's dark. It's very dark, and I don't mean to make light of it, but it is my life, so I can. I think that's just sort of part of what is in this book, is me talking about things that are hard, but doing it in a way that I find I'm never happier and I never feel better than when I'm writing. And I think that these moments in the poem where that have that energy to it, this sort of delight amid the dark stuff, is just me struggling to find that in life.
Well, I think as a reader, we also need that. We need that little break too.
And I'm glad you picked up on it, because a lot of times, you know, when I give readings, more so I think with the last book and the poems in there, because they're so dark, readers don't know what they're supposed to do when faced with something, or listeners, when they're faced with something that's funny. You know, because it is so dark. Like, can you really laugh about this stuff? And I totally get that, because as a listener, I would be the same way.
Yeah.
But I mean, to be fair, like, I think most comedy comes from a really vulnerable place. Like, most truly hilarious things actually have that under layer of depth, right?
Absolutely. I thought that calls to mind Hannah Gadsby and her Nanette, which I think in terms of talking about trauma is one of the most spot on things I've ever seen. And yet it's terribly funny, too. I think that's important.
And also, I mean, just as someone who's grown up in Southern California, the kind of commodification of the female body, the way that you're trained to identify your value as in someone in a shallow kind of entertainment culture, is like, it's horrifying and it's sad, but it's not untrue. Does that make sense? Like,
yes, absolutely. I think that was something like having also obviously grown up in Southern California, like you have to work at shaking.
Yes.
You just don't see yourself separate from that. And also this idea that like your worth is defined by either your body or your proximity to celebrity, you know, and that's something that I think about a lot.
Oh, for sure. But I would like to add to this too, that there's something really beautiful about this collection for me in many, many ways. But in one way, it feels that while you were talking about, you know, kind of rejoicing at being able to express or read expressed female anger at these kind of double standards and these ways, these things we live with that feel like a norm until we destroy it and change the paradigm. But there's also this wonderful softness that's moving through that Rand was addressing, but don't mistake that not for strength. You know what I'm saying? Like there's a strength in that as well. And so what I love is also how the idea of motherhood comes through really strongly in this collection. I'm thinking of the poem, "The Whole World is the Best Land I Ever Lived." Super strong example. And I love how when you're noting sources at the end, the title of this poem, you reveal as a sentence your daughter, Stella, spoke to you. So I'm wondering if you can speak to how motherhood has impacted your writing. That is, if it has impacted what you choose to write or how you choose to write it.
Yeah, that's a great question. I was at a show at Carnegie Hall where Brandi Carlile played all of Joni Mitchell's Blue album. It was amazing. And she, it was just once in a lifetime kind of thing. And she talks about how she at first wasn't into Joni Mitchell because she didn't feel like Joni Mitchell was tough. You know, she sings so high and she sings folk songs, etc. And then her now wife was like, do you know what some of these songs are about? And specifically pointing to a song that was about her giving up her daughter for adoption. And Brandi Carlile says, well, you know, that actually made me realize she was like the toughest person that I had ever heard. And I think this idea of reframing what is tough is an interesting one, right? Because we think of toughness as sort of macho or whatever. And this is pretty badass and tough to go through what a lot of women go through. And so that came to mind when you were just asking me this question, this idea of what is toughness. And I think being a mother right now, it gotta be really strong. It's very, very, it's difficult. And I'm raising two girls and the world is not as the world ever was. And so there's a lot that I have to navigate with them and for them and try to guide them. I think this is the first book that I write about my children, that my children are in. So this poem that the whole world is the best land I ever lived, which is a line that my younger daughter Stella said to me, I just wanted to, her heart is so pure and I didn't know if I could even capture it in a poem, but I managed to do that, I hope.
Oh yeah.
And it made me feel, and I think it sort of, it made me feel very vulnerable in a way that even writing like some terrible traumas didn't, just sort of getting her down onto the page. And then I have another poem in the book about, which I think I'll read a little later, called 12, which was about my older daughter when she was 12 and, you know, sort of navigating what that's like. We all remember adolescence. And I think, so I had never written about my children before these poems, but becoming a mother is what gave me the strength to actually even publish my poems at all. My girls were, I think, 7 and 4 when my first book came out. They just sort of inspired me to be truer to myself. And they made me stronger and they made me tougher, thinking that, look what I've done. Like, I've made these people, I've birthed these people, I'm raising them. What can't I do? And to know that you are so important to someone is a very unique feeling. And that also gave me the strength, I think, to write about the tough subject matter and to make space for people who have gone through trauma so that maybe we can eventually end this cycle of trauma that seems to happen generation after generation. And so I think motherhood just sort of inspired me to be truer to myself and to do more for the world, really.
I'm so glad you talked about that because that was actually my next question. I was curious about where you got the title for this poem. The other thing, I was wondering if as you were drafting it, because what you do is you have that opening image, which is like the pain of childbirth, and that sort of stays with me throughout the whole poem. I love how you open with this image and really, even though you kind of go, you talk about other things, that feeling stays with me in the poem. And I like the way that you take us through childbirth, baby first being home, then a 6-year-old. And you use second person in the poem as if you were addressing it, speaking to the child in a way. I mean, I was curious when you were drafting it, did you think about other options for that? Or was that just really how the poem came out as like a direct address almost?
I think it was how it came out, if I'm remembering correctly. I think there's something about my younger daughter where I really did feel like from the moment she sort of looked at me and she was in the bassinet, like she was on to me. Right?
As they are sometimes.
Yeah, I feel like second kids have that, you know, because they don't get as much attention. So they just have more time to like watch you and like figure out. But I just really felt that from the beginning. I'm like, oh, this kid like is on to me. And yet she forgives me for everything that's about to happen, right? Because I feel like motherhood is just like one mistake after another. And I think, and I just felt that very strongly. So I really was writing it to her to sort of thank her for her patience and her forgiveness. Not that she was asking for thanks at all. And she's 12 now and would probably just roll her eyes at me. But I do feel that I just wanted to somehow put into writing what it felt like. This sounds kind of out there, but what it felt like to be forgiven by an infant.
No, I get that completely.
Right? Like it felt really strong, even though she was about, you know, 24 hours old and just looking at me, but like I knew what she was telling me, and it changed my life a little bit, you know, to have that forgiveness. So that's what I was trying to get at in the.
Yeah, I get that.
So Yes Yes Books has published several of your collections at this time, your poetry. Can you tell us how you got connected with that publisher and just how that happened?
Yeah, absolutely. I've been very lucky. They've published now all of my poetry books, and it's really just a blessing and a fortune to have a press that you can stay with and that knows you. And we have such a good working relationship. KMA Sullivan is my editor. She's also the publisher of Yes Yes, and she just sort of gets me and always has. So they had just started when I had just completed my first book. Somebody who knew that I had manuscript, she was looking for more women. And what she was finding was that when she was approaching women as to whose poems she saw in magazines, whose work she liked, they always said, I don't have a book yet. I'll get in touch with you. And she was looking, she was getting frustrated. And I think, honestly, I would have held on to it for more years if I hadn't been approached, which I think is a lesson for all of us, just to put ourselves out there, because people are waiting for you to send your work. And it doesn't have to be perfect for you to send it. But anyway, someone approached me. So she wrote me an email and she said, could you send manuscript? And I'm curious to see it. And this seems like too good to be true, right? Like most of the time you're not just sitting around and someone's like, can I see your manuscript? But this did actually happen. And they were right at the beginning of their life as a press. And she did like it. And she took the book and it was one of the first books they published. And since then they've published, you know, so many amazing and award-winning titles, and they've really thrived. And she's definitely stuck by me in a way that I so appreciate. And I can't imagine being elsewhere with my poetry, because it just feels like my poetry home.
Yeah. That's wonderful when you feel that connected.
Yeah.
You talked about this a little bit earlier, but I wanted to kind of come back to it. I read in an interview in Lit Hub where you talked about your love of the writing process. And I was wondering if you'd tell us a little bit more about your process, and if you spend more time drafting or revising, is it sort of an equal split? And what in particular do you love so much about the process?
Yeah, it's funny. I think if I'm remembering this interview correctly, the Lit Hub one, because I think so many people complain about writing. They hate it. Which is also, you know, valid. I'm grateful that I'm not one of those people, because this is what I do. So I don't need to hate it. But I feel better when I'm writing than when I'm doing almost anything else. To me, writing feels like really good drugs or really good sex or something. Like, it gives me a high.
Mm-hmm.
Where I'm out of body, I feel connected to something larger than myself. Like, I feel connected to something spiritual. It feels like it's happening outside of my physicality almost. And that sounds really woo-woo, but I did grow up in Los Angeles, so I get to say things.
You can be woo-woo.
Yeah.
Probably why I'm vibing with it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I also am, you know, so I have that side to me where I just feel like I'm channeling stuff. And then I have my very practical side where I have to schedule the time to channel the words. But I find, you just don't know what's going to happen until it happens almost. And that's what's so exciting. Like, anything could happen. And everything, especially with poetry, everything is possible. Like, literally everything is possible in poetry. And I love that about writing poems. But even writing prose too, just this feeling of when you read it back, it's almost like somebody else wrote it. Like, wow, I did this. And then the revising process is one that I also love, which I'm constantly trying to get my students to love as much as I do. But revising is just, it's where the real, like, the magic happens in the writing, and the work, I think, is the revising. And I like that too, because you have the opportunity to really fine tune and get across what you want to say exactly as you want to say it. And you can do it from a less frenzied place. I always find first drafts for me, I'm in a fever or something. I'm just, I've got to get it all down. And I feel like obsessive and I can't think about anything else. And it feels very physical to me. Writing first drafts feels very, I feel it in my body. Revising is much more in my head. And I can just then go back and think about just getting it right. My relentless revising definitely can irritate my publisher, because it will be like going to press and I'll be like, can we just change this one comma? And she'll be like, really? But she's been
like, yes, really?
Yeah, I believe for this book, she was like, I'm just telling you up front, we can't be doing that at the very end of the process again. I think this time I'm going to be better about it. But I don't know. I think it's both of the things that I find enjoyable, but in different ways. Like I said, like, the writing is just super physical and overwhelming. And the revising is such a pleasure, because you're perfecting something. And I love that when you get, like, even just writing this memoir in prose books, 90,000 words, and I would get to a sentence that had to be really reworked. It was like one sentence out of, you know, so many sentences, but getting it exactly right feels like nothing else. It's such a good feeling.
Yeah, it seems like sometimes sculpting or something. Mm-hmm. Like, the first draft is like you're making this abstract looking fish in the marble or something. And then, and then when you're revising, you're like, oh, that's a trout. Yeah.
That is That is like the most perfect way of describing it. I'm going to have to steal that from my students.
Well, no, I feel that too. And I think part of it I've said before is just that in your mind, that first draft is so amazing because we're having that create, you know, you're creating, you're making that thing. But maybe it's when we get to the revision that we realize that what was in the mind didn't make it to the page. And so we're trying to kind of mitigate that struggle between what we imagined and what landed there.
Yeah, which can be so, like, you get this high, you've just written this thing, you're unstoppable.
Yeah,
and you're like, oh, shit.
I can't even tell you, I've been on the highest high. I'm like, I'm going to send this out right now. And then I'm like, whoa, self, pull back.
Yeah. I suck at this. I don't deserve to be better.
This will be brilliant for the first 24.53 hours.
That's right.
Then you will hate it.
That's right. You've got to enjoy it. Enjoy it while it lasts.
Yeah. So speaking on that idea of inspiration, though, too, what authors would you pick? Let's say you had one suitcase, you were going somewhere where there would never be more books arriving ever again. Who are the authors who light you up so much, or maybe who just spark your work that you feel like you would bring with you in that suitcase?
Oh, this is such a good question. And suddenly I can remember zero authors. Do you know how that happens? I think, yeah, I'll tell you who first came to mind. When you said that, one writer who has been deeply important to me throughout my life has been Alice Walker. I think I would for sure bring her work. There's something.
Oh, yeah.
There's something just so magical, but also really grounded about her work, which I don't read in a lot of, like, it's that anything can happen thing, but coupled with just a real forthright view of the world and where it is and where it should be. So I definitely bring her. I think I would have to bring Virginia Woolf with me, and maybe Emily Bronte. And I'm hesitant to name, you know, super contemporary poets because I'll leave some out, including people who I love. So I won't go there. But I think those three for sure are writers who have fed me the most, I think, throughout my entire writing career, just like in terms of sentences that I often come back to and just sort of phrases and even just like word choices of all of them just have always inspired and fed me. So if I wasn't allowed to get any more books, I think I would, they're all very, well, not Emily Bronte, but the other two are very prolific. So I'd have a lot of books.
Those are wonderful choices. That's a tough question, Heather. I'm thinking of a world where you cannot have more books.
Thank you. I'm a brutal bitch. That's it.
Very
I have one more question, and then we're going to talk about the cocktail and listen to you read. Yeah. But I was interested, and you mentioned this a little bit earlier about wanting to find joy and include joy. And in the collection with the poem, Listen, and the final line in that poem, which I love, is, listen, when I write poems again, I wanted them to be about joy. And I was wondering if you wrote that poem towards the end of the collection, knowing it was going to be there, or it was already written and you just lighted on it and you were like, oh, wow, this is the perfect poem to end the collection.
That's actually the last poem I wrote.
Oh, okay.
And it's actually how I felt. The book before this was very dark and heavy, and Refusenik is, I think, a little bit lighter maybe, but also sort of, you know, serious and difficult in sections. And I was feeling very done with writing heavy stuff, which is then why I embarked on this book that's part memoir and part about Dolly Parton, because I wanted to find joy. So I really meant that. I felt like I think it's the hardest thing to write, maybe just for me, but writing and expressing joy in words is a difficult thing for me. Which is strange because I tend to be a surprisingly optimistic, what my daughter would call sunshining personality, which is very different from my books, I think. But I want to take some of that and put it into poetry. And I think when I wrote that to myself, it was almost like a dare. It was almost a challenge that when I write my next book of poems, that's where I want to go. That's what I expect from myself, to sort of investigate this idea of joy. So really, it's kind of hanging over my head a little bit. Like, I'm
like you've set this challenge for yourself.
Yeah, and I don't know if I can hit it, but I will definitely try.
Well, I like the poem, but that line is really beautifully constructed. It really goes up, lifts up at the end of the line. So
I
thought it was a lovely ending.
Thank you.
Yeah, and I felt like it was about permission. It was about the author giving themselves permission to kind of transcend the abyss or something like that.
Right. That's, that's absolutely how I felt. Like, I feel like if I don't give that to myself and also challenge that for myself, then it won't happen. It's so easy to get mired in what isn't joyful because life is hard. You know, and again, I don't know if I can do it, right? I want to, I'm going to try, but it is definitely a goal. And I think just on a daily basis, just remembering joy is something that you have to actually work at sometimes. And I wrote that before the pandemic even happened. So now I don't know, finding joy takes on even more of a meaning after all of this tragedy, but I'm hopeful and I believe it's findable.
Yeah, for sure. And maybe it's less threatening if you think of it as a permission, like it's not an exclusionary permission, but it's a permission. It doesn't forbid you from the depth or the darkness. It just allows you an intention that you can move forward with.
Yeah, I love that's a great way to put it.
Well, so we're really looking forward to hearing from you read an excerpt from Refusenik. But before we do that, let's have Ran tell us about today's cocktail, which was custom created for this book.
Today's booktail cocktail is called a Black and White Russian, and the recipe's on the blog if you'd like to make a drink and enjoy it while you listen at home. Okay, so it's 2 ounces of vodka, 1 ounce of Kahlua, 1 ounce of coffee, and I used whatever coffee I had. I had, I think, cold brew, but anything would do, and then whipped cream. So you add it in a shaker with ice, you add all the ingredients, and you give it a shake. And you pour it into a glass and you top with whipped cream. And if you're feeling extra fancy, you can put a little sprinkle of cocoa powder or cinnamon on top.
Wonderful. Lynn, is there anything you'd like to tell us about the poems you're sharing today?
Yes. First, I want to say that cocktail sounds amazing.
Yay.
I'm absolutely making it. And as I mentioned to you too earlier, it definitely sounds like something that my grandmother would have had to drink. And so it seems perfect for this book because she
I love that.
It's in the book and it's a lot about my ancestors. So thank you for that. I'm going to read the first 4 poems in the book and then 2 from towards the end. So I'm going to read 6 total poems in case you're a reader who likes to keep count, because I know that sometimes that's helpful. And I will have some things to say about the poems as I read them, but nothing overall. Should I just get started with it then?
Yeah, do it.
Oh, okay, awesome. All right, so I'm going to start out by reading the first 4 poems in the book. And the first poem in the book is called The Night of the Murdered Poets. And the title of it refers to the night of August 12, 1952, during which 13 Soviet Jewish intellectuals were executed in a prison basement in Moscow on trumped-up charges of treason and espionage, and it came to be known as the Night of the Murdered Poets. There is a prayer mentioned in there called the Shema, which is regarded by many Jews to be the most important prayer in the religion. The prayer is basically a reminder that there's only one God, which is a belief of Jews. The Night of the Murdered Poets. I am writing this on a plane to California with several pens in my bag and all the water I want. It was evening when I left and will be evening when I get there. Sometimes I look at photos of myself and wonder why I was not smiling. It's hard to imagine we once mattered so much that they'd round us up. I mean poets. I know Jews have often been rounded up. I am contemplating a vermin metaphor here just because of how hard it is to get us. But I know better. I had to look up cosmopolitanism in my dictionary. Forgive me. I did have a school, but I didn't show up much. I was too busy trying to murder myself. Stalin thought cosmopolitanism contemptible and Jewish. Want to demolish the core of a community? Once upon a time, you could simply kill the poets. But more poets arose in their place. Well, more poets arose in this place, I should say. I was growing. What is the word for something that grows peculiar and withstanding? In California, like the orange tree, not native to the soil. The first poem I wrote was about bleeding from my uterus onto sun-drenched stairs. After the poets died in a prison basement, the Soviets smashed the Yiddish linotype machines. I had to look up linotype. When I left pencils behind, I bought myself a typewriter. I'm writing this on a laptop in the sky. After the poets died, the location of their remains was kept secret from their families. Their families were exiled to Siberia. Their families were social outcasts. I only just learned about this. I was a social outcast as a girl. I'd get so high I'd forget to brush my teeth. I want to remember how ill-starred the prison basement as I imagine it. I am finishing this on a plane from California. It was afternoon when I left and will be night when I get home. I believe in little. But I always say the Shema on airplanes. I want to remember that we'll never know the murder weapon, but we do know it, of course, dozens of metaphors deep. I want to remember that until recently, I didn't know any of this. The next poem in the book is called The Only Jew at the Mock Jewish Wedding. And it sort of refers to this mock Jewish, the weddings are held in parts of Europe by non-Jews where there's like this nostalgia for nearly extinct Jewish communities in those countries. And see, things you need to know. The word treif is a Yiddish word for a non-kosher food. And the word shtetl is the Yiddish word for any of the small towns that had big Jewish populations that existed in Central and Eastern Europe before the Holocaust. The only Jew at the mock Jewish wedding. My friend's missing father came from Mexico, but her mom wouldn't confirm it. Sometimes she insisted Greece, sometimes Peru. Eventually, we found proof in a Ziploc of documents. We also found a stash of pills and money. We took our giddy selves to the McDonald's on Wilshire near Fairfax, and I ordered the first treif I ever ate. It felt less momentous than I wanted it to. At the mock Jewish weddings, they serve pig. It's hard to tell if it's meant to taunt or just that in Radzinow, there are animals one expects to consume. My maternal ancestors told people they were from Glam Vienna, but they were not. They were from peasant Poland. The dictionary qualifies shtetl as formerly, but we never left. I once broke into a ballroom at the plaza, and all I could think to do was put my boots up on a fainting couch. Even at mock Jewish weddings, most fetish bores me, but I suppose it's a comfort to burlesque the joy of what you murdered. Who are we trying to trick here? I mean this to be answered. How are we different? This too. There's so much bacon in the world. We came to this country to pioneer having it all. Then we forgot why we started our own country clubs, white hands tapping cigar ash at another lavish reception. Assimilation is quick, also impossible. In Ukraine, where Melniks originate, figurines of Jews are sold as good luck charms. In America, I'm hanging on inside my own pocket. I dare you to watch me parade my costume here. I am not particle underneath. If there is no Torah in the synagogue, I am still proof it is a building. The next poem is called Getting On. I don't need to be told my body is not what my body was. Descending, live wire, the option to light. People keep telling me it's my ass or my face, but it's neither, and it's both. Tell me what to do about sliding into oblivion, about what is material and what will be remembered. Aging is a motherfucker, I say to myself. I fuck myself. I mother. When I'm alone, I document that I was here while I'm still here. The next poem is called When Bad Things Happen to Good People, and it takes its title from a 1981 self-help book by Harold Kushner, who was a conservative rabbi. When Bad Things Happen to Good People. You can only hear you look like a hooker so many times before you become one. Spandex was really big the year I stopped believing. I babysat for the rabbi's son, Isaac. There was luxe carpet in every room of the condo. Isaac liked Legos, and we made a pastor and a patriarch and lots of wives. In his car, in his garage, the rabbi handed me a self-help book and put my hand on his crotch, ready to go. I didn't care. I made good money. Isaac lived to be 180, according to the Bible. Isaac is the only patriarch who didn't have concubines. Isaac is 30 now. Modern scholarship tells us the patriarchs never existed. Survival has taught me the patriarchs are what we've got. And then I'll finish with two poems that are more towards the end of the book. I'm going to read a poem called 12, which I wrote for my older daughter, Ada. And, you know, as I said earlier, I didn't used to write about my kids, and I tend to write about things that consume me or that are unsolvable. And my kids, when they were younger, seemed so, you know, pure, and there, I had no angst about it. And then my oldest turned 12 and a lot of angst happened. So I began to write about it and I wrote this poem. 12. When I was your age, I went to a banquet. When I was your age, I went to a bar room and bought cigarettes with quarters lifted from the laundry money. Last night, I did all your laundry. I don't know why I thought this love could be pure. It's enough that it's infinite. I kiss your cheek when you sleep and wonder if you feel it. It's the same cheek I've kissed from the beginning. You don't have to like me. You just have to let me keep your body yours. It's mine. When I was your age, I went to a banquet and a man in a tux pinched my cheeks. When I was your age, I went to a barroom and a man in a band shirt pinched my ass. There is so much I don't know about you. Last night, I skipped a banquet so I could stay home and do your laundry and drink wine from my grandmother's glass. When I was your age, boys traded quarters for a claw at my carcass on a pleather bench while I missed the first few seconds of a song I'd hoped to record on my backseat boombox. When I was your age, I enjoyed a hook. You think I know nothing of metamorphosis, but when I was your age, I invented a key change. You don't have to know what I know. And then I'm going to finish with a poem, which is a love poem. And it's also, it's called Tikkun Olam, and which is a Jewish phrase for to repair the world. There's this idea that we're obligated to repair the world as Jews. And there's also this notion that, of course, we won't be able to finish that work, but we are obligated to undergo it. And so this poem is both a love poem and also a poem that speaks to this idea of repairing the world. Tikkun Olam. 46 and out on a Friday night in the stiletto boots I waited months to buy because I'm cheap, but that's a dangerous cliche to use given what's been said of Jews and are Jews people? Cable News asked me one morning, and don't think I haven't ripped out my own heart to stop it from beating back a confused reply. One day I woke up and I couldn't digest. Last summer it hurt to close my fist. The diner waiter keeps asking me if I have enough. Is it enough? What is enough? I love you. I'm overdressed even for a soliloquy, even for a Valentine's Day, even on Shabbat, especially for the tables in this diner. That's laminate you're leaning on, Lynn, not marble, where I first blurted the wish that started all of this. The night is new. The night shows me a sky I do not deserve, both wanton and elegant, me in my boots, the sky, in which I'd never seen before, not really, not before you held my hand across the laminate, even though it has been up there, biding its time my entire life. You touch my leg under the table. You order pie. I'm here to talk about humanity, and all I can think about is how you look at me. The Mishnah tells us together we must repair the world, and still I have little faith in a God who gives us this, yes, perfect moon slinking through the skyscrapers into the diner as if that's enough. Thanks.
Wow, that was such a great reading. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So great to hear your voice bringing the work to life.
Wonderful. I have a question that's a little bit of a departure of what we've been talking about.
Sure.
It's about your writing community. I'm always really interested in who we have or don't have around us when we're writing. So I was wondering if you have a person or people with whom you share your work with, or maybe that you write with.
I do. I've been very lucky in my life to have such a good community. I mean, first of all, I'm married to a poet. Yeah. My husband is Timothy Donnelly, and he's a poet, and he is my first and best reader and editor. And so I have that in my own home, which is very lucky. And so, you know, I have that, and I have, for prose, I have a beautiful writers group, which has gotten me through writing prose for the first time. And that's been wonderful. And I have several friends too, who, when I write something, I feel completely comfortable in just saying, like, I'm sending you this poem. Does the ending suck? You know, like, and what is great about having a community of friends who I trust is they will tell me if the ending sucks, right?
Yeah, that's so important. Like, yeah. Tell me if it's bad, I need to know.
Yeah, if a friend can tell you, well, I love you, but you can do so much better, that's much more valuable than someone who loves everything you do.
Totally.
So I do. I am very lucky to have that around me. And one of the other things that I have, which isn't me working on my own work, but in teaching, I get so much out of thinking about other people's work and how it's constructed and how it can be fixed and changed and how it evolves, that I think that is a side benefit of that, is that it sort of strengthens my own practice.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I'm a teacher also. And another thing that helps me too is when I've been a reader for writing competitions, when I read other people's work in that capacity, that also helps me.
Yeah, absolutely. It just lets you think, I think, about how work is constructed, but without the angst that comes with it being your own.
Right.
And so right. It's one of it. Yeah, go ahead.
Do you have any advice? I think that probably getting a writing community is one thing, but do you have any advice to offer new poets or prose authors?
Honestly, and this is what I tell my students all the time, is that I have had a lot of just super magnificently, like, you know, innately talented students. And I've had those who weren't. And the ones that who are successful are not necessarily the former. The people that I know who are successful, not success even in terms of books and accolades and jobs, like success in terms of realizing their goals, their writing goals for themselves, are those who stick with it, those who do the work. And this goes back to really my belief in setting up a writing practice for yourself. You have to get in the habit of making the time to work on your writing, or time slips away so easily. There's a gazillion streaming services. There's so much to do. Like, there's a lot we could be doing besides writing. And so my advice is, it sounds really very simple, but my advice is to write, but to do it in a deliberate way, because it's a time slips away. And I've both seen so many talented people just sort of fade away and not realize what they wanted for themselves. And I can say that it almost happened to me. Like I said, I was 39 before my first book came out, and I had to really get focused. I had to commit to myself and to my writing. So my best advice, I mean, writing community is great for keeping you writing. Right? You're accountable. If you have a writer's group, you're accountable to sending those pages by whatever date you're meeting. But that's really the best advice, is to make it a regular practice, whatever that means for you. You know, everyone's busy. That means you write every 2 weeks. Okay. Or you write for 2 months straight in the summer. That's whatever that means. Just keep at it.
You know, it's so funny because while you were talking about that, weirdly, I was picturing the Dolly Parton movie 9 to 5. And thinking about every soundbite I've ever heard Dolly Parton in, which always makes her feel like such a real person, but also someone who kind of rolls up their sleeves and does what they need to get done, like with her literacy program and helping all those kids back where she's from, and just so much stuff like that. So it's weird because I was hearing this, in my mind, connected synchronicity between what you were saying and why you would pick Dolly Parton as an influence for your upcoming book.
She has this quote, which I'm sure I'm going to get wrong because I don't have it in front of me, but I'm paraphrasing here, where she says, like, dreams are of no use if they're not equipped with hands and feet and wings. You know, like, you have to actually work at what you want, because otherwise it's a wish and not a dream. And I think that's really, she says it much better. So please look it up. But I think that's basically the idea. Like, work, there has to be work behind whatever talent you have, whatever dream you have, and whatever wish you have for yourself. You have to actually put in the effort to do it, or it doesn't happen. There's just so much in life that can get in the way.
Yeah, absolutely. For sure. And she touches so many different cultures and everything. You don't even have to be a country music fan for her to be totally iconic.
Yeah,
and easily called to mind. So I want to give you an opportunity right now, just for a moment, to maybe speak to that new book before we close out.
the memoir.
Yes, right. Can you tell us a teeny bit about it as a teaser for readers who might want your book and then your next book?
Yeah. So the Dolly Parton book, it's called I've Had to Think Up a Way to Survive on Trauma, Persistence, and Dolly Parton. And it is memoir in prose. And it is basically a love song to Dolly Parton. It's like a third of it is about my life, and a lot of it is about trauma that I've suffered and sort of how I've gotten beyond that, and how Dolly has really inspired me to overcome a lot of things, and how she's been a real constant in my life. I mean, not in real life, I wish, but her music and her, and just her being. And so it's about, you know, it also explores her songwriting, her musical talent, and her cultural impact. And it deals with a lot of the same themes as my poetry does. You know, it looks at, you know, rape culture and misogyny, and it talks about a lot about religion and my Jewishness. And then it also looks at what an incredible talent Dolly Parton has, which often gets overshadowed, right, about by the other stuff about Dolly Parton. So I'm trying to sort of raise awareness almost of her absolute genius as a songwriter and a musician.
That sounds wonderful. I cannot wait.
I can't wait to share it with you.
Oh, great. Well, thank you so much for spending time with us today at Book Tales. We really, really enjoy talking with you and hearing you read your work.
It was such a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me and for making a cocktail for this book. I feel very cared for. Thank you.
Oh, this was a delight. You're such a wonderful guest. And everybody, please order Lynn's book, Refusenik, and be sure to check out www.hotredheadmedia.com and subscribe to the blog for more information on the booktales, readings, and drinks for this podcast series. Also, subscribe to this podcast, which releases once a month, for more conversations with amazing literary authors. Thanks again for listening to Booktales. See you next time.